Boy, what an age we live in. We can communicate in every conceivable fashion. Radio programs, television programs, the internet. It is an age of communication, and every one of these avenues of communication has been used as a technique for getting the gospel out. You know, mailing, mass mailings to communities, radio programs for religious preaching and so on. Well, even those machines that dial up your phone while you're eating supper, they'll call you and offer you a Bible study. Well, all of these, of course, are ways of communicating the gospel, and since the power of the gospel is in the message and not the technique or the person that presents the gospel, it's possible that somebody can simply pick up a tract from the ground and read it and learn something about the gospel. They can just read their Bible and know what it is they need to do to become a Christian. And yet, if we did a survey of everyone here this morning, I am confident that 99% of us became disciples of Jesus Christ because somebody invited us to do so. And that is a reminder of the personal dimension that is so crucial in the presentation of the gospel. And that is something we need to appreciate about God's wisdom. You remember the story of Cornelius, a Gentile who's a righteous man, and yet he needs to hear the gospel. An angel appears to him and tells him how to find a preacher who will teach him the gospel that he needs to hear. Paul himself on the road to Damascus, the Lord appears to him and says, "You go into town, and there's going to be a preacher there who will tell you what you need to do." Why is that? Well, it's a reminder to us that that's God's chosen technique, that it's God's method to use people to convey a message that is about ultimately relationships. Do you realize how ironic it is when we realize the gospel is about a relationship, ultimately our relationship with our Creator, a relationship with one another made in the image of God, and we communicate that so often in such impersonal ways? But that is not God's intention. I'm ambivalent about PowerPoints somewhat because of this very fact. Now, as a supplement to a lesson to help people understand the outline of the lesson or appreciate and follow along more easily, that's fine. But it can easily become a distraction. It can become the focal point of the lesson rather than the message itself. And especially if we start using, you know, 3D graphics and every bell and whistle that comes with the program in terms of what kind of animations it can do, and letters are swirling around and popping in, and we could add audio to all of that, and it becomes entertainment. The power of the message is not in what animation you use on your PowerPoint. It's in the content of the Word of God. But I'm reminded of what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 8. As he rehearses how he brought the gospel to Thessalonica, he says that we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but our own lives as well. And so for all of you who are here today, welcome. Especially if you're one of our visitors, we want to give our lives to you. We want to give our lives to one another. That's also God in His wisdom. People think, why can't I stay home and read my Bible? Well, you can. But what you will not get is this interpersonal interaction, this relationship that God has called us to. And that's why we come together. We're simply trying to be the kind of Christians you can read about in the New Testament, worshiping God as best as we can, trying to understand what God has revealed in His Word, and trying to follow it as best as we can. And we always welcome anyone who has that intention and that same purpose to join with us in that endeavor. And so if you would, turn to John chapter 4 this morning. We're going to look at a story here where a woman issues a very simple invitation to the people in her community to come see a man. And I would suggest to you that this is in essence what we are trying to get people to do as well. We're not wanting them to come see a man, this preacher, Oh man, we got this great preacher. Well, come see this guy. We're not trying to get people to come see a church, a group of people. We're not trying to get people to come see some program. We're trying to get people to see Jesus. And asking them very simply, will you come see Jesus? And if we are confident that Jesus is presented here every time our Bibles are opened, that as Paul says in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 1, that even though the Galatians had never witnessed the crucifixion of Jesus, they were not there. They were converted decades later. But yet Paul is able to say, you before whose eyes Jesus was publicly displayed as crucified. When the gospel is preached, it is the same as presenting a video picture of the very crucifixion of Jesus. And so every time we meet together and study our Bible, Jesus is presented, Jesus is proclaimed, and people can come see Jesus. Now, do we really believe that? Do we really have confidence that Jesus is being proclaimed in this place? Well, if not, quit coming. And go find a place where Jesus is presented. A place where you can have confidence in asking people, won't you come with me and see Jesus? And that's what this woman does on this particular occasion. Now, we've had the first 15 verses of John chapter 4 read for us, and we're introduced to Jesus as he's sitting by this well, having this conversation with this woman, this Jewish man, this Samaritan woman, probably the oddest pairing together. They should have been on the Jerry Springer show. It's such an odd combination. And the disciples are flabbergasted when they show up that he's talking to this woman. And Jesus is discussing with her about water. She's come out to get literal water. And Jesus says, if you only knew, I could have given you living water, spiritual water, water that if you drink, you will never thirst again. Now, it seems to me that Jesus and this woman kind of got off to a rough start somewhat because as you read the story, it seemed to me she has something of an attitude. And if we could kind of piece things together a little bit, we find later on here in a moment that she's been married 5 times. And she's presently just shacking up with somebody. Now, even in the ancient world, that was beyond the pale. I think we're getting the point now where that's not so uncommon to us. But I would hope most people in our society would still find that kind of odd, that somebody would be married that many times. Well, certainly in the ancient world, that was pretty extreme. This woman is on the margin of her kind of moral conduct. And that may be the explanation why she comes out to draw water at 12 o'clock noon. That's a very uncommon time for people to come out looking for water, but if she was kind of an outsider, if she was kind of the neighborhood tramp or whatever, she might not want to be rubbing elbows with too many people too much. But she gets in this conversation, and Jesus says, well, if you'd ask, I'd give you a living one. She says, well, you don't even have a bucket. You know, where are you going to get this living water? You know, you think you're greater than, you know, our father Jacob? And so she's not too impressed at his ability to offer to her this great water that he is suggesting. And so I don't know in verse 15 if her request, oh, well, give me this water, is really sincere in that if she's become convinced that he really has something to offer her, or if she's just like, well, yeah, okay, show me. Yeah, go ahead and show me. You big bragger, you know. I don't really know where her attitude is at this point. But Jesus turns the attention to where it needs to be, and that is her need for this living water. And that's the real issue. As long as people don't perceive that they have a need, they're not going to look for what answers that need. And so Jesus is going to highlight her moral condition here. He says, go call your husband and come here. And the woman said, well, I have no husband. And Jesus said, you rightly said, I have no husband, because you've been married 5 times, and the one you're now living with is not your husband. You've really spoken the truth there. And so the woman now says, I perceive that you are a prophet. How could this stranger to town know her whole life story, as she'll describe it later, everything I've ever done? He must be a prophet. And then she asked this question, our fathers worshipped in this mountain. Y'all say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. You know, you Jews, apparently is what she means. Who's right about this? And some people have accused the woman of trying to change the subject. You know, Jesus is getting too close, too personal with her. But, you know, if you've just discovered you're talking to a prophet, you might be interested in the burning theological question of the day. Are the Samaritans right that we ought to be worshiping on Mount Gerizim? Or are the Jews right that we ought to be worshiping down in Jerusalem? And notice Jesus' answer. He says in verse 21, woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. So shortly, something's going to change, and it's not going to matter whether you're worshiping here or down in Jerusalem either. But you, that is you Samaritans, worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. And so he answers her question. The Jews are right about this, that you're supposed to be worshiping down in Jerusalem. But notice again, he repeats verse 23, an hour is coming, and even in some sense, he says, now is present, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people, the Father seeks to be his worshipers. Why? Because God is spirit. And those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. Matter of fact, one of the songs we sang this morning, number 511, reflects the wording of this very passage, that we worship in spirit and in truth. And of course, my whole life growing up, this passage is always cited as proof that we ought to worship with sincerity because if our heart's not in it, our worship isn't worth anything to God. And it also needs to be done according to the truth. It ought to be doctrinally correct according to all that God requires of us and how we worship, or it also is not acceptable to God. And those things are certainly true. That's just not what this passage is talking about. Now, before you run out and say, oh, preacher said we don't have to be sincere in our worship and we don't have to do it the way the Bible teaches, that's not what I said. The Bible teaches such a thing, just not in this passage. What's this passage mean? It's obvious that God has always wanted worship that was from the heart, that was sincere, that had our spirits participating in it. And it is always true that God has always expected his people to worship according to the directions that he gave them. We approach God in his holiness on his terms, not ours. Joshua himself, as we get to the end of the book, told the people, worship him in sincerity and truth. There is not a thing different about that in every age past or present. And yet, notice what Jesus says. A time is coming where this is going to change. And what is changing is not sincerity in worship. What is changing is not the doctrinal correctness of worship. It's something else that's changing. And so I think we need to understand the word spirit and truth in a different way than they're normally understood. And you think about this. What is it that's changing? What is it that's going to happen that will make a change? Well, I think it's pretty obvious. It's the coming of Jesus. That when Jesus accomplishes his work, things are going to radically change. And what's going to change, again, is not the sincerity of God's followers or the correctness with which they do what God tells them to do. That's not what changes. What changes is, with the coming of Jesus Christ, with his crucifixion and resurrection, sin is removed for real. And that barrier between God and man is no longer there. And now a worship of God is possible that was not possible before. A worship of God that could not be done under the old covenant. And what kind of worship is that? Worship that's true to God's character. Do we really think that the God of the universe, who created everything, can limit worship to a physical location? Do we think that worship of such a God is rooted in a physical animal that one kills and the blood of that animal somehow appeases this God? Obviously not. If you think that's what it's all about, you don't understand God. God is a spiritual being. And the kind of worship that is consistent with God's character and his very essence and nature is worship that is spiritual, not physical. What do we mean by that? Well, I think a good example of this is in Hebrews chapter 8, where the writer observes that the priests under the old covenant serve a copy and shadow of the true tabernacle. And of course, he's talking about heaven. Now, he's not talking about a true tabernacle as opposed to a false tabernacle, that tent that Moses built, you know, that Israel put together under his leadership, that was a false tabernacle. That's not the point. It was a model. It was a pattern. But it wasn't the real tabernacle. The real tabernacle is heaven. And I think that's the same sense in which Jesus is using the term spirit and truth here. This is true worship, not opposed to false worship. It's not saying the worship of God throughout the Old Testament was false. It was true worship in the sense that it was genuine, it was sincere, it was in keeping with God's instruction. But it could not be the ultimate worship, the full worship that could only come in Jesus Christ, that could only come with the removal of sin from our life. And so Jesus is saying to this woman that question about where you worship, down in Jerusalem at the temple or here at Mount Gerizim, yeah, that's important under the old covenant. But shortly that's going to be a moot question, because it's not about where you are. Worship is going to be spiritual. Worship is going to be genuine and in keeping with God's character. And so that's what's radically changing in Jesus Christ. Now, what that says to us is that we are privileged to live in an age where we are capable of a kind of worship, a kind of closeness, a kind of intimacy with God that was not possible in ages past. And we ought to appreciate that. And so in response to this, the woman, just all she can say is, I know that Messiah is coming, and when he comes, he will explain everything to us. You know, Jesus has raised some rather deep and profound questions, raised some issues. He's made some affirmations that really have got her to thinking. And she says, well, when Messiah comes, he'll explain all of this. And then Jesus simply says, I who speak to you am he. Can you imagine what it would have been like to be on that occasion? Here for centuries, God's people have been expecting the Messiah. And this woman has been out here in the middle of nowhere, just him and her, by this well. And she certainly started out not having a very good, positive picture in her mind of who this fellow was. But now he claims to be the Messiah. And it seems as if she believes that. She was convicted that he was a prophet because he knew everything about her life. But now he claims to be none other than the Messiah. Can you imagine what it would have been like to be this woman out there speaking face to face with the Creator of the world? Speaking face to face with none other than the Messiah. Speaking face to face with none other than the one who will judge her in the last day. Speaking face to face with the very one who's going to give his life for her sin. Now, I don't know how much of that she understood at this point, but it appears at least that she came to understand that he is the Messiah. And this is the point at which they appear to be interrupted. So notice in verse 27, at this point, his disciples came and they were amazed that he was speaking with a woman, and yet no one dared to say, well, what are you looking for? Why are you talking to her? They had been with Jesus long enough to know that they ought to be a little bit reserved about these things. The woman left her water pot and went into the city and said to the men, come, see a man who told me all things that I have done. This cannot be the Christ, can it? And they went out of the city and were coming to him. And you can just picture this, filming it as a movie, you know. The woman has left and she talks to these men and they leave town and they're on their way. And meanwhile, we flip back to the disciples. Meanwhile, the disciples were urging Jesus, saying, Rabbi, eat. And he said, I have food to eat you don't know about. And the disciples were saying to one another, well, no one brought him anything to eat, did they? And Jesus said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Do you not say there are yet 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white unto harvest. And some have even suggested by this point that you could see the people coming from the town approaching the well, and Jesus could quite literally point and say, look, here comes the harvest. It is time to reap souls for God. Others have planted the seeds. You are privileged to harvest this produce for God. And so the Samaritans come to listen to Jesus. And so in verse 39, from that city, many of the Samaritans believed in him because of the word of the woman who testified, he told me all the things that I have done. And so when the Samaritans came to Jesus, they were asking him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. Many more believed because of his word, and they were saying to the woman, it's no longer because of what you said that we believe. For we have heard for ourselves and know that this one is indeed the Savior of the world. Well, let's think about what we can learn from this woman very, very simply. The first thing I would point out about her is she is a person who is convicted of the fact that Jesus is the Messiah. And on the basis of that conviction, she acts in a way that is consistent with that. And I would suggest that when you look at the story here more closely, it could have easily been quite different. If this woman, in fact, is looked down on by most of her neighbors because she's a little bit morally iffy, this woman having been married so many times and now just shacking up with this guy, that could have easily dissuaded her from going into town, putting her neck out even more, making a fool of herself. And it does appear something of that is reflected in her statement in verse 29 when she says, this can't be the Christ, can it? And she does phrase it in such a way that it expects a no answer. And so some have concluded that she didn't really believe he was the Messiah. She's just basically saying, hey, you come out and see some nut I met at the side of the well. But of course, he can't be the Christ. But, you know, he's a nut, so come hear what he has to say. You know, our cable's been cut off. Come out and hear this lunatic, you know, rave. Well, I don't think that's the case at all. I think clearly she knows him to be the Messiah. The reference of the people here when we get later, the people say, you know, we believe because of what you said about him. Clearly she thought he was the Christ. And then they go on to say that we believe him more because of what we've heard him say himself. So then why does she phrase it that way? Well, we do the same thing. I don't know how many times guys will ask a girl out saying, you don't want to go out with me, do you? Well, if you really don't think she wants to, why bother her by asking, you know? Well, we do it because we're so timid and insecure and we don't want to presume and we're setting ourselves up for rejection. We feel bad enough about that. And so I think this woman is a little bit tenuous in, you know, what are people going to think of me? You know, come running in saying, the Messiah's here, of all places on the face of the earth, out here in Samaria, by some well, and you're the one that he meets. You know, what's the likelihood of that? And yet it's her conviction and her simple invitation to these people to come see this man. And they respond to it. And I'm sure that part of it was more than just that she went around saying, well, come see a man out by the well, come on. You know, convicted people don't talk that way. You know, my grandfather loved fishing, and sometimes I would go fishing with him. And I, of course, was always the one. Boy, as soon as I'd see that little float move, I'd be like, oh, I'm going to pull that fish out. And wouldn't give him a chance to get hooked on good. My grandfather would always say he wasn't convicted, you know. And he was just being nice. It was really my problem not to fish. But, you know, that's how grandfathers are. But I thought about that. You know, people, if you're really convicted, it's almost like something just hooked you inside. An external force just grabs a hold of you and pulls you. But, of course, in reality, this conviction is an internal force. And we need people that are convicted. And what do you see of convicted people? The Ethiopian, as Philip preaches to him, and they're riding along in the chariot, and you don't see Philip going, hey, here's some water, what do you think? Huh? And start arm twisting and cajoling. And no, the man's convicted, and he says, hey, here's some water, why can't I be baptized? That's what convicted people do. And here is a woman who is convicted, and she leaves her water pot, and she goes into town, and she says, here's the Messiah. Come see this man who told me everything I've ever done. Now what you see on the hand of the disciples, however, isn't that kind of conviction. They've already been to town. They have surely interacted with and spoken to some of those Samaritans. They could have extended the same invitation and said, "We invite you to come out to the well. The Messiah is out here. Won't you come and listen to him?" Probably the reason they didn't get a following coming out to the well was because they didn't go to town for that. They went to town for food. And what did they bring back? Food. And if what we do is we go out looking for food, that's what we're going to find. But if we go out with conviction, interested in spiritual things, looking for a harvest for God, we're going to find some harvest. But we've got to be convicted. We've got to have that power that grabs us and brings us to where the Lord wants us to be. Secondly, I think you see the concern of this woman. She could be convicted, "Man, I've met the Messiah," and then just go home and keep quiet about it. But she also has a concern, clearly, for her neighbors, you know, what other family she might have had in the area, that kind of thing. And so the first thing she does is she goes to the townsfolk and she says, "Come see this man who's told me everything I've ever done. Is this the Messiah?" And out of her concern for her neighbors, she offers a very simple invitation. She didn't try to oversell it. She didn't try to browbeat them about it. She just didn't go on and on about it. She just says, "Won't you come and see?" And she gives a very simple reason why. "This is what he's done for me. This is what I find compelling about it. He told me everything I've ever done." We can offer simple invitations to people to come see Jesus. And if we try to oversell it, you know, we just keep doing talking. You know, people get the sense we're trying to sell them something, you know. We're trying to hoodwink them into something. It isn't that. Just simple conviction conveyed in very simple faith. Come see Jesus. Come see Jesus. Now, third thing I think we can see about this woman is her confidence as well. And you see that reflect again in the way that she invites the people. She doesn't feel the need to sell the product more. It'll sell itself. That if the people will simply come out and listen to Jesus, if she simply extends the invitation, they're going to come. And in fact, they do come. And they will hear for themselves what Jesus has to say to them. And furthermore, it says that many people here in this city of the Samaritans believe, but it doesn't say all of them did. We have to be confident the gospel will do its work, and those that are looking for the truth will find it, and those that don't want it won't. And there's not anything we can do about that. And we simply have to be content to allow the gospel to do its work and to find those that are looking for the truth. And ultimately, it's really not about us. And you see that reflected here at the end of what we have read when the people said, "You know, yeah, we believe because of what you initially told us, and you extended us this invitation to come see him and told us he told you everything you've ever done. But now we've heard for ourselves." And that's what we need to remember. It's not about me. You know, I'm just extending an invitation. Come see a man. Don't come see me. Come see a man, Jesus. We're just simple messengers. We're just simple inviters. Jesus is the one that will do the talking. Jesus is the one we're confident is going to convict them. The power is in the gospel. But the gospel not only communicated through words, but also, as we said at the beginning, communicated through our life. Because it's our life that demonstrates there's conviction to this message. We really believe it. It's really changed our life. And I think it's that aspect more than anything else that's going to help this relationship of bringing others to the gospel. I mean, if it were merely about the words, why wouldn't God's chosen method just be print a bunch of Bibles and bombard the nation with them? Why is it he wants people taking the gospel, but that it is their own conviction in that message that is part of the message, part of the sense of what this is all about? And as we said, it's a message about relationship after all, so that's ultimately what it has to be about. And then finally, we see that this woman is constrained. She's compelled to act. The urgency with which she acts. Verse 28, she leaves her water pot. What she came out to do. And I don't know what all she needed water for that day, cooking and cleaning and whatnot, but she didn't take care of the business she came out to take care of. She started her day, her to-do list had something on it, didn't get done. Because something more important came up. And the urgency of whatever that water was needed for was forgotten. Her water pot is forgotten. And she goes to find those people in town and say, come see this man who told me whatever I have done. Now there's an urgency here too. Now, on that particular occasion, I don't know if she thought, this is the one time the Messiah is in town. He wasn't here yesterday, may not be here tomorrow. And I think often we think in terms of, those brethren at 58th Street Church, they were here last week, they're going to be here next week. Well, we don't know that. This may be the last Sunday we're here. One day is going to be the last day we brush our teeth. It's going to be the last day we drive to work. It's going to be the last day we hug our kids. One day is going to be the last day for everything. And we don't know when that's going to be. There is an urgency about inviting people to come see Jesus. It's not because Jesus is missing. Jesus is either here or not here. It's we may not be here. And whether the end of time comes and then it becomes a moot point, or just our own personal time comes that we're gone, we're no longer able to extend that invitation. There is an urgency about this. But ultimately, it all boils down to this ultimate question of whether we are converted. I think what we find reflected in this woman, now the story didn't go on to tell us that she became a follower of Jesus, but I think that's pretty well implied. But she gives every evidence of being a converted person. She's convicted. She's concerned. She's confident in the message, in Jesus, not herself. And she's constrained and compelled to act upon that. That's a converted person. Now, we can claim to be converted. We can claim to be followers of Jesus Christ, but we're lacking any of these elements. We're not really converted. We haven't really changed. We're not really following Jesus. We're really just still doing our own thing. And so the ultimate question for us is, how converted are we? And what aspect of our conversion may be short? Is it our conviction? We really don't know Jesus. We don't really believe in the promises of God. We really don't believe in the power of the gospel. Is it our concern for people that we're lacking in? Yeah, there's lost people all around us. Do we care? Do we have compassion on those that are lost as our Lord and Savior did? Do we have confidence that if these people are invited that at least some of them will come to see Jesus? Do we have confidence that at least some of them will see the power of the gospel and act upon it? Do we have confidence that it is in the hands of God now, as long as we've done our part? Are we constrained to leave our water pots behind and to act urgently to see that the invitation is given, that people may come and see Jesus? Well, again, there's lots of ways to communicate. There's one way of communicating that's more important than any other. There's a point at which you need to come where you throw yourself on the mercy of God and humble yourself. You don't do that through a radio program. You don't text God. You don't get on the phone and talk to Him. You don't send Him a letter. You can do it anywhere. You're not constrained by time. It's a communication that takes place solely between you and the Lord. The moment you decide, I'm sick and tired of doing it my own way, and I want to throw myself at your mercy and do things your way, to repent of my sin, to be baptized into Christ, to live a life that God wants us to live, and to have that hope of being with God for eternity. If you will, take your songbook and turn to number 583, and we'll sing this as a song. 588, okay. Turn to number 588. We'll sing this as an invitation song at this time, and how appropriate it is, an invitation, come and see Jesus. A man who knows everything that you've ever done, and the one who will be the judge that will set in judgment of all of us on that last day. And the one that we can look in the face and be with in fellowship for eternity, to speak with forever. Can you imagine the companionship of being with God, much less being with all of the great worthies, those people of faith we read about in the Bible? But to be with God, speak with God, what will it be like? Truly a glory and a blessing that awaits us. If there's some way we can help you even this morning, let us know while we stand and sing the song of encouragement.